Can we just stop for a minute and acknowledge the fact that a child just asked us all where she goes when she dies? It's not really something you prepare yourself for when you're trying to throw together a service with a story for all ages. What answers do we give? Especially when you're a UU minister and you've been taught specifically not to answer that question. And that's why these spaces are so important. Because we need to give our children a place to ask those questions safely and freely. Now, some sermons have a very, as I say, all right, now. I'm going to be up here for a while if y'all want to sit somewhere else for a minute. We'll find some time to let you get back up, but I'm going to be here for a minute. And this is a weird one, so I want to make sure I can see your faces. So some sermons have a very direct, clear point. Not necessarily the ones I preach, but some do. And then there's this other kind that's very broad. You know, we're just hitting on a bunch of topics, trying to introduce something. And then there's this kind that sort of represents the inability to fully grasp a complete understanding. A sermon that takes place in a miasma of ever-changing faith. And this is the one I'm preaching today. That one that I'm not sure where it went and where it's going. So keep that in mind as I introduce to you the December theme of mystery. But to keep the track of the shifting reality of this sermon, I will lay it out for you before I get into it. We're going to start in the 80s, the late 80s. Our main character is going to be sitting on the floor watching television, and I'm going to tell a few jokes about old commercials. Feel free to laugh. But don't worry, we're going to move quickly on from there to a topic that might sound a little bit like killing God, which is always a wonderful UU topic. But remember, that's not the point of the sermon, it's just sort of an aside. And from there, it's just going to continue to get weird. We're going to start with some H.P. Lovecraft. We're going to zoom through a little Descartes. And then it may sound like our main character believes that we're living in a computer simulation. And at some point, it's going to feel like, Justin, you're digging a hole. You probably should stop, but I'm going to keep digging the hole. So are we living in a simulation? Well, you'll just have to wait and see. I'm not there yet. And then from there, we might even take an opportunity that sounds like we might even resurrect God a little. Not in an Easter kind of way, but through the acceptance of the idea that there are just some things we'll never understand, and that's okay. But see, we're not there yet. We're going to start the journey. We're going to zoom in on a kid sitting in front of a floor-model Quasar television in 1988. You know what I'm talking about, right? Raise your hand if you actually don't know what I'm talking about, a floor-model television. James, really? I'll show you pictures. They were awesome. In the 1980s gave us many wonderful commercials. During that time, I was mostly watching children's TV. So many of the commercials I remember involve He-Man, G.I. Joe, the Care Bears, and the Ninja Turtles and Transformers. You know, the commercials for toys that were made into a series to sell more toys. But as I grew older, I'd begin to remember the barrage of other commercials that snuck their way in. See, I know when it's time to make the donuts. Does anyone know that commercial? Okay, I see some nods. I remember the woman who has fallen and can't get up. And is that a little too close to home? there's also this woman who kept asking, "Where's the beef?" And I will never forget Wilfred Brimley warning us about diabetes. And then, if that wasn't enough, 12 new albums for a penny from Columbia House. Yes, a penny. Calgon, take me away. Yeah, I sat in my living room 3 feet away from a floor model Quasar television. I had to stay close because I was the remote control for my dad. Food commercials, toy commercials, local commercials. You weren't from where I was, so you wouldn't know Kenny from Wheeling, West Virginia, who would tell you to call 1-800-LEAKY-BA and he would fix all your foundation and basement leakage issues, reminding us that you got to call me, I can't call you. And then there was Time Life and Time Life books. You know those Time Life books, right? Right? Time Life wanted to teach you everything, whether it was auto repair, home renovation, World War II history, or gardening. My favorite came out in 1988. Mysteries of the Unknown. Oh, my dad and I, we were very seldom on the same page about what to order from the television, but for some reason, we were totally on the same page about this one. After the commercials, we just had to get this. And if you don't know this series, Mysteries of the Unknown, it's a 32-book series that explores mysteries of the unknown. Strange phenomena, mystic places, like strange things that happened at the pyramids or in ancient pharaoh tombs, magical arts, cryptid encounters like Bigfoot and UFOs. Oh, I loved it. See, now understand that I was a 10-year-old boy going to school talking about Aleister Crowley, Vlad the Impaler, and Bigfoot. I devoured this series. Every time a new copy would arrive, I'd tear open the box and get into that book and just devour it. I read the series over and over again until I would finally move away when I turned 18. And those books are still at the home my parents live in now. I asked about him once. My father told me he didn't have them anymore because I had this tendency to walk away with his things as I got older. But someday, those books and a complete set of 1984 Encyclopedia Britannicas will be mine. See, I grew up with a sense of mysticism. When I told my grandmother that there was a monster in my closet, she didn't tell me I was seeing things or I was crazy. She told me how to get rid of the monster. Her house was covered in crystals, pyramids, and many different kinds of divining tools. You know, I grew up reading the mysteries of the unknown at home and living them with my grandmother. I grew up with this significant sense of mystery, and it wasn't just the mysteries of the unknown books. It was the Encyclopedia Britannica. Because I would check the stuff in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Because I needed to understand stuff as a kid. I needed to make sense of the metaphysical world and how it interacted with this physical world and that how that interacted with the Christian faith in which I was raised. I needed answers. And over the years, I would get answers, but for some reason, the people giving me the answers did not really seem to approach the questions with the depth of thought and research I had already poured into them. As a child, adults would often write me off when I asked the hard questions, especially the ones that made them uncomfortable. I asked a youth minister once, "Can you prove to me there is a God without the Bible?" And he stammered. I realized he'd never given this a thought. As Unitarians, sometimes we might start shifting a little uncomfortably in our seats, maybe because I'm going to say some uncomfortable things about God or because I'm going to mention God at all. But for that Church of Christ guy, when I was 15 or 16 years old, he did not know what to do when I asked the difficult question. Can you prove to me there's a God without the Bible? He stammered. And I could realize as I watched him process, he didn't like the answer that he kept coming back to. Because the answer is no. He did not have the tools to show any evidence to make any moral or philosophical argument. Which means God, whether they exist or not, will always be a mystery. And by definition, the moment God stops being a mystery, we will know without question that God is dead. Which might sound like a bold statement. And if you're a specific kind of theist, it might sound like blasphemy to say God is dead. And if you're, or God will be dead. And if you're a non-theist, it sounds like I'm saying there is absolutely a God if you hear it the wrong way. When in truth, I'm saying neither. But let's put that up on a shelf. Well, no, we're going to go a different direction here for a minute. H.P. Lovecraft, he wrote in The Call of Cthulhu, he says this in the very beginning paragraph. It is one of the most macabrely beautiful statements I have ever read, and I take the opportunity to read it aloud anytime I can. He says this, "The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little, but someday the piecing together of disassociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein, and then we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age." See, I love the opening line to that story. He says, "The most merciful thing in the world is the inability of the human mind to correlate its contents." Now, H.P. Lovecraft, if you don't know or have not read any H.P. Lovecraft, is a 20th century horror writer. And he lived in utter and complete fear of the world around him. Modern horror writers have all read H.P. Lovecraft. But the world that he lived in, that he couldn't make sense of, it gave him nightmares and night terrors, and he would take his bad dreams, and he would write them into stories to try and make sense of them, and it would later be understood in a genre called cosmic horror, which is horror that is so big there is nothing we can do to beat it. All we can do is accept that it's going to happen. He created beings like Cthulhu, Nyarlathotep, Dagon, the crawling chaos, or simply the thing that should not be. His monsters, ugly and tentacled, represent his fears of the outside world and the people who live in it. Lovecraft articulates in these monstrosities that they are so much bigger than us that simply seeing them and perceiving them would drive us mad. Maybe because they are scary, but more so because they bring us face to face with our own sense of insignificance in the cosmos. Man, that sermon just went straight to the toilet. But for this sermon, remember this line. "The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all of its contents." His greatest fear is not just the unknown, but whether or not we can know. Of course, that question of what we can and cannot know, I think it's epistemology. Someone correct me if I'm wrong. Whether because we don't have the processing power in our brain or the psychological fortitude to handle is not new to humanity. That is an old, old question. As Lovecraft describes it, the inability of the human mind to correlate its contents. But see, remember why we're here. I began this sermon sitting in front of a four-model Quasar TV, which led me to asking a youth minister to prove that there's a God without the Bible. Upon hearing certain limitations, I jumped directly to cosmic horror and fear in the idea that my brain will never be big enough to understand the most important questions. And as I realized that I can't actually know there is a God, I thought H.P. Lovecraft would help, and he just did not. In all reality, and regarding this sermon, it feels like I'm stuck in a hole trying to dig my way out. Its sermon feels like digging a hole, and you know what they say when you're digging yourself into a hole. Let's keep digging. So we're going to keep digging. I remember a dream I had. Oh, it's going to get bad, folks. You never want to hear your minister say, "I remember a dream I had." I remember a dream I had. I know it's a big shift, but just go with me for a minute here. And I remember waking up in that dream, so I got dressed and got ready to go, only to realize that I was still dreaming. Some of you might have done this before. Some of you might not have, but no, it's a fairly common, uncommon thing. People do it. And then I realized I was still dreaming and still had to get up, so I did. And when I got up this time, the characters that had been with me in the dream were still walking along beside me, and I looked at them and said, "Aren't you part of my dream?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "Well, shoot, I'm still dreaming." See, that was a few months ago, and I have dreams since, so I think I'm awake now. How about you? Are you awake? You know, not in the, "Oh my gosh, I'm sleeping through a sermon" style, but are you awake out there, or is this just a dream for you? Are you dreaming that you're in church listening to one of the most frustrating sermons of your life? Maybe you're sitting there thinking, "This can't be real. Why would Justin keep going on like this? Can someone please get him to stop jumping around topics?" Well, all I can tell you is, I don't think you're dreaming, because I don't think I'm dreaming. But if I am dreaming, you're simply part of my dream, which sounds like I'm just digging myself deeper, which means let's keep a digging. All the way to Cartesian skepticism. Cartesian skepticism. Let's go there for just a minute and talk about René Descartes, who puts the Descartes in Cartesian. A philosopher and mathematician from the 17th century imagined an evil demon as he tried to figure out what he can really know skeptically. He imagined an evil demon that employed all of its powers to deceive. And the Wikipedia article says this of the, it calls it a malevolent god or an evil demon as imagined to present a complete illusion to an external world so that Descartes can say, "I shall think that the sky, the air, the earth, the colors and shapes and all external things are merely the delusions of dreams which he has devised to ensure my judgment. I shall consider myself as not having hands or eyes or flesh or blood or senses, but as falsely believing that I have all these things." Let me get a drink of water while you think about that. The idea is, in Descartes, can we know if anything is real? Or is everything I think real just this demon messing with my mind? See, today we don't believe in evil demons, which is why this idea was updated in 1968 to the brain in the vat theory. Brain in the vat theory, anyone ever heard of it? Okay, so it's this idea that they've got a brain, your brain is in a vat somewhere, and there are all kinds of wires and stuff connected, and a computer is running simulations based off of what's happening to you in that theory, which, oddly enough, is one of those Lovecraft stories as well. You know. And it was a few decades earlier, though. But just remember that these scenarios are all thought exercises in Cartesian skepticism that worked in trying to figure out what we can know, epistemologically. Today, the most common expression of this idea is through the dream scenario. Are you dreaming, and am I just part of your dream? Of course, I would think that I'm dreaming and you're just part of mine, but maybe my paycheck will tell me something different. But my favorite aspect of the skeptical scenario, the one I like to mess around with the most, we are all living in a computer simulation. You may want to get that on video. Just come to my church. We are all living in a computer simulation. I was thinking about the simulation hypothesis Thursday around noon while I was sitting in Bishop Carlton Pearson's funeral. It was a celebration of life, a celebration of the change he helped foster, the celebration of the ups and the downs of the life he's led. And I thought, maybe we're just in a video game played by someone else. Maybe we are a science project or a reality running on some supercomputer. Maybe, and just go with me for a minute, maybe we're living in an apocalyptic future where machines have taken over the use of our bodies for power and kept us happy in such a dream scenario, a matrix, some might say. I really thought that would get a laugh, but that's okay. A version of the thought experience goes on to say, what if we are a simulation created from another simulation that was created by a programmer from another simulation? See, it's just turtles on turtles on turtles here. And I realized, this was the thing I realized while I was sitting at a funeral. It's good I wasn't speaking at the funeral, but I was sitting at a funeral and I realized, you know, really I don't care if this is a simulation or not. See, philosopher David Chalmers takes on his thought experiment, this thought experiment, in a way that really speaks to me. He points out, one, that physicists have been exploring this concept for years, and in the end, to physicists, it's all just data that we're interpreting anyway. But it still teaches us something about the world we live in. And we know because of Descartes, who said, I think, therefore I am, when he said, how can I know, can I doubt that I'm doubting? I can't doubt that I'm doubting, therefore I think, therefore I am. And he said it in Latin in a really fun way, and I'm not even going to try. Does anyone want to shout it out, the Latin, I think, therefore I am? Yeah, we're not going to do it. See, whether we're in a simulation or not, I go home to this woman I really love every day. I have these two kids I love very much and love to watch explore the world and to find new things and to work on their dreams. I have two dogs and a cat that I love very much, that whether this is a simulation or not, when Delta Dawn is lying there next to me, she is warm and soft and we care about each other. And whether it is a simulation or not, I love being here very much, getting to speak all sorts of crazy from the pulpit. And I realize as I keep digging this hole that what I'm talking about now, the exploration, the question I asked sitting at the bishop's funeral the other day, that's not a new question for me. Am I living in a simulation is basically the same question I asked so many years ago in Wheeling, West Virginia. It just sounds a little different. Back then, the question is there a God that you can prove to me exists? And the honest answer I've come to realize sounds so harsh if it just wasn't so freeing. Can you prove to me there is a God without the Bible? No, and I don't really care to. Even if there is that great programmer in the sky or whatever simulation is above us, it doesn't change the fact I'm going to live my life in a way that is rooted in love for others because I choose to do it. Not because of what they think of me, this programmer. I don't know, you know, maybe I'll get the flash drive that goes to the next iteration or something, get put in the flash drive. Or And I don't know what's going to happen when that giant hard drive crashes. Doesn't mean I'll stop looking for answers, but it really makes me think it's fun to look for the answers to some of these questions. But they don't change anything about the way I care for other people. Whether there be a God or not, I care for everybody the same. Some people would say, you're living as if you believe. And I would say, no, I'm living as if I believe it's important to be good. I don't know if this is a simulation. Probably not. You know, if you really were to try and nail me down on this, I'd probably say it wasn't a simulation. I would say this is probably not a dream. But, you know, someday we may get proved wrong and the hard drive crashes. We won't know. And it doesn't mean we stop looking for answers. See, I'll always be a mystic that read the tarot cards with my Christian grandmother, who used pendulums and various other divining rods to find things. My grandmother who listened to God so much that she stopped using the pendulums and just listened for what it sounded like God was saying to her. My grandmother who saw beyond me in the statements I made about the fears of what's living in my closet and instead gave me helpful advice on getting rid of the stuff in my closet. My grandmother that said, I don't know what this is. It's just a gift from God. See, I'll live with the mystery of what all this is. I live with the mystery of what I can't perceive to be. Oh, if an article comes out about proving any of these theories, yeah, I'm reading it. I'm reading it. It'll probably find its way into another sermon. Don't worry. But day to day, I can live happily knowing that I do not know and probably will never know the answers to these questions. Well, there are questions that I'll look for answers to, but these ones are just sort of fun. I don't know. We'll never know, because the minute we know, the question no longer exists. And the funniest thing is, I was watching a video and preparing for this on Cartesian skepticism, and they said, so here are the three arguments they made classically, and here are three modern arguments. And that's what brought me to David Chalmers, because I was sitting there reading it or listening to this thing, and I thought, well, what if I just don't care? What if it really doesn't affect my life very much, because at the end of the day, I get to go home and hug my wife. Whether that's data, whether it's flesh, doesn't matter. I get to do it. And I'm okay with that. Thank you for listening.